Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
The Economist. Hello and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm Jason Palmer.
And I'm Aura Ogunbiyi. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world.
I must say I don't know a whole lot about luxury handbags, but even I can see that there are fewer obvious knockoffs out there. The fakers are just getting too good, and that is throwing off the economics of the whole industry.
And, on average, my dad has a glass of wine every evening. I've known how to use a corkscrew since I was about 10, but still, I rarely drink wine. In fact, lots of young people drink less alcohol these days. What does this mean for France's wine producers?
First up, though, in video from Syria's capital, Damascus, last night, the Iranian consulate lay in smoking ruins. Syria's defense ministry claims Israeli aircraft targeted the building with airstrikes. Among the 7 officials of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps who were killed was a senior general, Mohammad Reza Zahedi. Israeli officials haven't commented on the allegations, but Iran's ambassador to Syria aimed at them when he said that such crimes will not remain without response. Meanwhile, 7 aid workers were killed in Gaza when an airstrike hit a marked van operated by World Central Kitchen, an airstrike that the agency's boss, Aaron Gore, called a targeted attack by the IDF. The war in Gaza has long been drawing opposition abroad, opposition that's noticeably hardening even among Israel's staunchest international allies. Now, the opposition at home is coming to a boil. Yesterday, protesters gathered outside of the country's parliament, demanding elections to oust Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. But that might be an even more dangerous and chaotic path.
So the war's reached a very difficult stage for Netanyahu. He's under quite a lot of pressure at home for a number of reasons. One of them is that there's a tension between getting the hostages released, one of his aims, and another, which is to destroy Hamas, whatever that means. And those two things, he's finding increasingly hard to do both at the same time.
Edward Carr is The Economist's deputy editor.
Second thing is his coalition is under danger. Number of reasons there. One of them is that there's pressure for ultra-Orthodox Jews to fight in the army. They're currently exempt, and they're an important member of his coalition. And the third is growing tension with the United States, Israel's main ally, where President Joe Biden is putting a lot of pressure on Israel to take more care, allowing the supply of food and medicine, and for Netanyahu not to fight in Rafah, which he says he's determined to do. All these things are coming together. Netanyahu is under pressure from every side, and he's trying to find a way through.
So with all of those pressures building, as you say, how does this strike on the Iranian consulate figure in?
Well, we don't know the Israeli intelligence behind this, so there could be specific reasons why these generals and officers have been targeted. But this is a reminder of the stakes in this war. It is not just Hamas. It is also Hamas's ultimate backer, Iran. And it does at least serve to remind people that there is a bigger picture here from the terrible scenes that we're seeing inside Gaza.
So is that to say you think Israel is trying to make that reminder more explicit by carrying out this strike?
I don't think we can say that with confidence, but I do think that's one of the consequences. Remember, at the start of this war, the US sailed 2 carrier strike groups precisely to deter Hezbollah and Iran from joining the war from the north, which looked like a real danger at one point. And this kind of widening of the picture, I suppose it recalls the sense that there is this key danger that's there the whole time. And until Iran is dealt with in some way, either deterrence is reestablished or it becomes clear that nothing more is going to happen, until that moment, the escalation of this war to the north will always be a risk. Up to this point, it's been noticeable that Hezbollah has not really wanted to escalate. There's been this shadow war going on, but it's increasingly coming out into the open. And attacks like this could lead to the escalation that people have been dreading.
At the very time that Israel's allies abroad seem to be putting more pressure on them to change tack.
That's true. But I think if there were to be an outbreak of war that Iran had ordered, there's no question that the United States would stand beside Israel. Absolutely none at all, in my mind. So in a way, Netanyahu is kind of forcing the contradictions to expose themselves. At least that's one consequence of this. Whether that was the proximate cause of this, we just don't know at this point. The intelligence is secret, and Israel hasn't even acknowledged that it is behind the attack.
I take your point about a war initiated by Iran, okay, but at the same time, there's news this morning of strikes in Gaza killing aid workers again, and that plays into this ongoing narrative about pressure on Israel to change its tactics in Gaza.
You're completely right. You have a split screen here. You also have 7 aid workers killed this morning, all sorts of nationalities, Americans, Canadians, Australians, British, Polish, from the World Central Kitchen, who were distributing aid to people who are starving. And there is a clock ticking inside Gaza of famine and of people dying, and that will continue to go on. And that is something that has been capturing world attention and has particularly exercised the United States in recent weeks, especially because as you've had the dire warnings about starvation inside Gaza from the UN, among others, you've also had Netanyahu saying that he wants to prosecute a further attack in Rafah in the south.
You say that clock is ticking in Gaza, but how does that play into the rising tensions that you mentioned earlier within Israel and the pressure, for instance, about the hostages?
Well, of course, Netanyahu is in a very difficult position at home. It starts with his personal unpopularity. He has charges over his head for corruption that are going to be heard in court. His government was unpopular because of a judicial overhaul that had led to immense civil strife last summer before the Hamas attack. And he's now trying to hold together a coalition of far-right Israelis who have expansive plans on trying to take more of the West Bank, of taking on Gaza, who spout all sorts of incendiary rhetoric about loosing atomic bombs over Gaza. He's trying to do this and to keep as much international support as he can. And it's kind of classic Netanyahu is to try and keep every plate spinning at the same time, to antagonize the Americans at the same time as knowing that he needs them, trying to keep his coalition together and therefore not say anything about what happens to happen in Gaza after the fighting's over, because he knows it will upset them, even though that leads to a cost inside Gaza because no one quite knows what's going on. It's a big mess.
But dealing with all those tensions, keeping all of those plates spinning, doesn't that put Mr. Netanyahu in a delicate position? If any one of those plates should fall, isn't it potentially political curtains for him at last?
You'd think so, wouldn't you? But there's another way of thinking about this, which is in the middle of the war, to undergo a complex process that could take 3 months or more in order to replace him, leaves the country in a perilous state. And so the heightened danger that Israel is in is actually a reason for seeing this through before he's replaced. So it's paradoxical, isn't it? The mess following the Hamas massacres on October 7th, the mess that since that date Netanyahu has created, the deepening tensions that he's allowed to continue because he hasn't resolved these contradictions, in a way actually serves him because it makes the job of replacing him even more perilous than it would be if everything was in order. And so you have this, I think, really unhealthy situation where things aren't resolved that need to be resolved. And perhaps the greatest of those is that there isn't a plan for what happens when the IDF have finished their operations in Gaza. You really need a sense of how you're going to keep order afterwards. And you need a governance structure to be able to stop Hamas coming back. And you also need a governance structure if you're going to have any sort of peace plan in the future. None of those things are really possible while you live in this kind of advanced state of chaos and contradiction.
Thank you so much for your time, Edward.
Thank you, Jason.
Little bit of housekeeping here for the benefit of listeners to Editor's Picks, our show featuring articles read aloud from the latest edition of The Economist. We're changing things up a bit. It'll now be published from Monday to Thursday. In each day's short episode, you'll get one shiny new hand-picked article read to you by folks with better diction than mine. We hope you enjoy the brisk and frequent new format. Okay, on with the show.
World peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world, and in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
You used to be able to spot a fake handbag a mile off.
Alice Forward is The Economist's Wall Street correspondent.
If you walked down Canal Street in New York, you'd see plasticky Prada wallets, which only bore a passing resemblance to the ones on sale in the Prada store in Soho. The fake Chanel bags lying next to them were lumpy, misshapen, and smelled a little bit like petrol. Any attempt to make a quick buck by buying one and passing it off as genuine would have been met with raised eyebrows and a chuckle. But these days, there are dupes that are spot on, even down to having precisely the right number of stitches. The New York Times has called them superfakes.
The quality of knockoffs today is at a whole new level. And
that is complicating the market for secondhand luxury bags, which has become vast and widespread. Those interested in purchasing a genuine handbag now risk being swindled. And all this has made the market a much more interesting topic for economists.
Alice, how did superfakes come about?
So there are a few things that have radically changed the market for luxury handbags and the resale market for those bags over the last decade. The first is that demand has just been absolutely booming. So LVMH, which is one of the largest luxury conglomerate brands, it makes about 3.5 times as much revenue from selling luxury leather goods as it did 10 years ago. By contrast, the global economy has only expanded by about 30% over that time. At the same time, there's been technological change. So you now have dedicated online platforms like The RealReal or Vestiaire Collective. You can now buy basically any bag you would want to secondhand. And total resales of luxury bags and clothing around the world now add up to about $200 billion a year. All this has led to a much more significant opportunity for producers of counterfeit goods. What we've seen is that they have really upped their game as well. Makers of fake bags in China are now so talented at copying the real thing that women gather in Reddit groups to quality check these bags. They get very close to the real thing. They're always talking about whether or not they'd wear the bag itself into the real boutique.
And why are economists becoming so interested in this?
Well, economists have always been gripped by questions about how markets can function when information asymmetries exist, when the seller of a good knows more about the quality of it than the buyer does. And this topic was the subject of a paper by George Akerlof back in 1970, which he called The Market for Lemons. And he actually won a Nobel Prize for that 31 years later. His paper was about building a model for the used car market in America. Bad cars are known as lemons. And if you stick with me for a bit, you'll see the parallels with the fake handbag situation.
Okay, I'm sticking with you. Talk me through this used car model.
He builds a simple model in which there are four kinds of cars. So there are new cars and used cars, and there are good cars and bad cars. The new ones are worth more than the old ones, and the good ones should be worth more than the bad ones, which again are called lemons. What he does is he assumes that a car's owner will learn over time if it's a lemon. Its problems will become clear, it will break down, etc. But that will not be obvious to any potential buyers of that car. And they'll be forced to offer the same price to a seller, whether that car is good or bad. And that price will have to take into account the risk that the buyer might be getting a lemon. So offer some hybrid price that assumes maybe a 50% chance that the car is bad. And that means that the sellers of good cars will be unable to fetch a fair price for their vehicles. They'll be more inclined to withdraw from the market. That will drive down those prices because the share of bad cars relative to good cars will increase. And in comes Gresham's law. This is the law that says that bad money will chase out good if they trade at the same value. And lemons in the used car market will chase out the good cars. What this model implies is that the market for good used cars, for ones that actually work, might vanish entirely.
So by extension, the market for secondhand handbags could be at risk here?
Yes, exactly. You've spotted the parallel. Luxury handbags can also be new or used, and they can be real or fake. And the original buyer will know whether they bought their bag from Fifth Avenue, ordered it via WeChat, or even picked it up on Canal Street. But the potential buyer that they might be selling to in a secondary market will not be able to tell because these dupes are so good now.
But Alice, surely by now there are ways to tackle that information asymmetry, the gap of information between the buyer and the seller.
Yeah, well, you might have noticed that there are markets for used cars, and they tend to function best when there are independent third parties who are able to step in and adjudicate quality. So often it's easier to sell a used car to a mechanic or a dealer who can do some sort of quality checks and might be willing to provide a guarantee to a less knowledgeable buyer. Those kinds of intermediaries who can assess quality are helpful in making these markets function. And there are these kinds of parties in luxury handbag markets as well. So the RealReal and Vestiaire both say that they do quality authentication, they do quality checks, and luxury brands try to make it possible for these firms to do that by providing things like authenticity cards or serial numbers. But a lawsuit that went to trial in January of this year has revealed how it's increasingly difficult to be able to authenticate secondhand bags. This lawsuit was brought by Chanel against What Goes Around Comes Around, which is a luxury vintage store in New York, which says that it provides 100% authenticity guarantee. But during the trial, Chanel revealed that in 2012, 30,000 authenticity cards were stolen from the warehouse of one of Chanel's manufacturers. And it was just the cards that were stolen. No bags went missing. And at the same time, Chanel provided evidence that What Goes Around Comes Around had sold 50 bags with voided serial numbers. And in the end, the jury sided with Chanel. The vintage store's founder, Seth Weisler, stood by the firm's 100% authenticity guarantee, saying that the case was not about selling counterfeit bags, but about selling bags which had serial numbers that were voided in Chanel's database. But as we learned, there are all kinds of reasons why those serial numbers might be voided. And it plants a seed of doubt about what is being sold. It will make buyers worry that maybe even the professionals can't be trusted anymore.
Okay, it's all looking pretty hopeless, especially for people like me who cannot tell the difference just by looking at them. But it sounds like this could be especially bad according to the theory of lemons, right?
Yes, so Akerlof's market for lemons theory suggests that this market might collapse entirely because all the bad bags will chase out the good ones as quality becomes more and more difficult to prove. And I don't think anyone should be happy with that outcome. Obviously, it's bad for the resellers, the vintage stores and the RealReal, because their business would no longer be viable. But I also think that it's probably bad for the brands as well, because you hear this a lot from people who buy Chanel bags. But one of the things that's appealing about them is that you know that there's this robust resale market. It makes it much easier to spend $10,000 on a bag if once you have it and you realize you're not using it as much as you like, you can sell it for, say, $8,000 in a resale market. And if that market goes away entirely, I'm not entirely sure that would be good for Chanel or any of the makers of these bags. My overall takeaway is that it's probably wise for these companies to now use their many resources to find a more robust way for people to know what they're getting in secondhand markets.
Alice, thank you so much for coming on the show.
All right, thank you for having me.
coffee.
The French really do love their wine.
Sophie Pedder is The Economist's Paris bureau chief.
Schools in France once prized its nutritional value. It was so commonly served to children that the government in 1956 banned wine in school canteens. And even then, it only did that for the under 14s. Today, France is the world's biggest wine producer. And a bottle of wine has long been to the French meal what fast driving is to the German motorway. A humdrum habit, a national right, and a personal pleasure. But that seems no longer to be the case. In 2022, only 10% of French people drank wine every day, and that's down from half back in 1980. A glass of wine, let alone that once familiar pichet, is an increasingly rare sight at the lunchtime table these days.
Sophie, what's going on?
Well, it's not just a matter of price, Ori. When you look in the supermarket, you can find a bottle of Bordeaux, pretty rough stuff, but for under €3. That's quite cheap. And I've even seen in some wine cooperatives in rural France that you can buy wine straight from the vat. You put it into your canister, you bring a plastic canister and you pour it from the vat for less than €2. That's cheaper than fresh orange juice. So I think one explanation is that the beer drinking trend has spread from the north of Europe down and is challenging Mediterranean habits. I looked at some polls and you can find the French saying they now prefer beer to wine. And in supermarkets, the sales of beer now account for half of all alcohol that is bought. Even in southern France, which has this very long wine drinking tradition, you can go into cafes and find imported Belgian beer on tap, which is quite a turnaround. And there's another thing. Health-conscious younger people, I find, are just drinking less.
And that's the thing, isn't it? We're not just drinking less wine. I mean, personally, I find myself drinking a lot less of any alcohol, really.
Well, it's absolutely on trend with the generation. If you look at the 18 to 35-year-olds, a quarter of them in France say they never drink alcohol. And roughly 40% of the under 35s, they say they don't drink wine. That's very different from the older generation, where especially the over 50s, you have only a quarter of people saying they don't drink wine at all. I've been quite struck by the fact that Dry January, the French pronounce it Le Dry January, has entered the national lexicon. You hear them talking about this on talk shows. And even in supermarkets and shops, you can find no and low alcohol drinks now on the shelves. There was a marketing slogan that Pernod Ricard, that's a big giant drinks company that's French owned, that they ran. And they were trying, I think, to tune into Generation Z with the phrase, buvez plus. And then the answer was d'eau. In other words, drink more water. I guess they probably meant that they wanted you to drink water in between downing their spirits too.
Okay, so what does this all mean for France's many, many wine producers?
Well, of course, you know, fine wines are still being drunk and bought in France and they're still being exported. If you look at the quality wine market, it's still very strong. But it's the cheaper stuff and it's the decline of drinking that end of the market that really does have wider repercussions for France and for French wine producers. Last summer, the government spent €200 million to buy excess low-end wine that producers just couldn't sell. And you can see it's even beginning to affect the countryside, where if you go to parts of southern France, there are farmers who are ripping out some of the vines that don't produce the quality wine altogether. So although less booze is going to be good for your health, it's not necessarily going to improve the mood among farmers or the landscapes of rural France.
Sophie, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, sorry, for your interest. Great to speak to you.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.